Welcome to the Flash Notes Podcast, the podcast for busy professionals that need knowledge now. Brought to you by Flash Notes Book Summaries at getflashnotes.com, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. My name is Dean Bukhari, your host here at the Flash Notes Podcast, where every week we work to bring you the big ideas and actionable insights from some of the best business and self-improvement books out there to help you succeed in life and in business. So tune in, buckle up, and enjoy the ride as we dive into today's episode right here on the Flash Notes Podcast. Okay, so I am excited today because we have a new partner here on the show. We have recently partnered with Amazon's Audible, which is basically a place where you can go to get tons, 150,000 plus titles that they have in their database right now with full-length audiobooks, right? So if you enjoy getflashnotes.com and you're a member there, then you know that we've got plenty of 20-minute audiobook summaries to listen to. Now, Audible is pretty much the same thing, but they focus on a wider scope of different books, topics, and categories. And they've got, again, 150,000 plus titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on your iPhone, your Android, your Kindle, or your MP3 player. And so what we've done is we've created an awesome promo now that we've partnered up with Audible. And what you can do is go to audibletrial.com/Dean, and you can get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial at Audible. Again, that's a free 30-day trial with Audible plus a free downloaded audiobook, full length, whichever one that you want to choose. So check it out. Go to audibletrial.com/Dean. audibletrial.com/Dean. Check it out. It's an awesome promotion, and I really, really am excited about this new partnership that we've got going on with Audible. So come on over. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Dean, D-E-A-N, and hook yourself up. Hello, everybody. This is Dean Bukhari coming back at you with another Flash Notes audio book summary. And today we are doing a audiobook summary on Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Now, Daniel Kahneman is a renowned psychologist and winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. He basically takes us on a groundbreaking tour of the mind and explains the two systems that drive the way we think. There's System 1, which is fast, intuitive, and emotional. And then there's System 2, which is slower, more deliberate, and more logical. Now, the impact of overconfidence on corporate strategies, the difficulties of predicting what will make us happy in the future, the profound effect of cognitive biases on everything from playing the stock market to planning our next vacation, each of these can be understood only by knowing how the two systems shape our judgments and our decisions. Kahneman reveals where we can and cannot trust our intuitions in this book, and how we can tap into the benefits of slow thinking. He offers up practical and enlightening insights into how choices are made in both our businesses and our personal lives as well, and how we can use these different techniques to guard against the mental glitches that often get us into trouble. Let's jump into the first idea, which is how our behavior is determined by two different systems. One is automatic and the other considered. There's a compelling drama going on in our minds, a film-like plot between two main characters with twists, dramas, and tensions. These two characters are the impulsive, automatic, intuitive System 1 and the thoughtful, deliberative, calculating System 2. As they play off against each other, their interactions determine how we think, make judgments and decisions, and how we act as well. Now, System 1 is the part of our brain that operates intuitively and suddenly, often without our conscious control. Now, you can experience this system at work when you hear a very loud and unexpected sound. So what do? You probably immediately and automatically shift your attention towards the sound, right? So that's system one, when you act immediately. This system is a legacy of our evolutionary past. There are inherent survival advantages in being able to make such rapid actions and judgments. And system two, though, is the part of our brain when we use, when we visualize ourselves or consider our mind. It deals with conscious activities of the mind, such as self-control, choices, and more deliberate focus of attention. For instance, think about looking for a woman in a crowd. Your mind deliberately focuses on the task itself. It recalls characteristics of the person and anything that would help locate her. The mind's focus might even eliminate potential distractions, like other people in the crowd. If you maintain this focused attention, you could succeed and spot her within a matter of minutes. If your attention is distracted, your chances of success diminish. The relationship between these two systems determines how we behave depending on which system is in command. Your mood, whether relaxed or tense, is directly affected as well. The lazy mind. How laziness can lead to errors and affect our intelligence. Try this famous bat and ball problem yourself to see the two systems in your mind working. A bat and ball cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? The number that most likely came to your mind is 10 cents, right? Which is a result of the intuitive automatic system one, right? Immediate. And guess what? It was wrong. Take a second and do the math now. Do you see the mistake? The correct answer is actually 5 cents. So what happened was that your impulsive system one took control and automatically answered by relying on intuition, but it answered too fast, way too quickly. Usually when faced with a situation it can't comprehend, system one calls on system two to work out the problem. But system one is tricked by the bat and ball problem. It perceives the problem as simpler than it actually is and incorrectly assumes that it can handle it all on its own. It's crazy stuff, isn't it? The issue that the bat and ball problem exposes is our innate mental laziness. When we use our brain, we tend to use the minimum amount of energy possible for each task that we take on. This is known as the law of least effort. Because checking the answer with system two would use more energy, our mind won't do it when it thinks it can just use system one. The laziness is unfortunate because using system two is an important aspect of our intelligence. So research shows that training system two tasks like focus and self-control lead to higher intelligence scores overall. The bat and ball problem illustrates this, as our minds could have checked the answer by using system two and thereby avoiding having made that common error in the first place. So in other words, by being lazy and avoiding using system two, our mind is limiting the strength of our intelligence. Next big idea, autopilot. Why we are not always in conscious control of our thoughts and actions. So what do you think when you see the word fragment, quote, S-O-P, right? So just kind of spell that out in your mind as you're listening. Just capital S, capital O, little underscore, where it would kind of be like you're playing Jeopardy, where you see the S, you see the O, you see a blank underscore where a letter should be, and then you see the letter P, right? You probably think nothing when you see that. But what if I first said the word eat? Now when you look again at the word S-O blank P, what would you think? You'd probably try to complete it with the word soup. Right? So this process is known as priming, according to Kahneman. We're primed when exposure to a word or concept or event causes us to summon related words and concepts. If you'd seen the word shower instead of eat above, you probably would have completed the letter as A, and you said soap instead of soup. You get what I'm saying? So such priming not only affects the way we think, but also the way we act and behave. Just as the mind is affected by hearing certain words and concepts, the body can be affected as well. Now, a great example of this can be found in a study that found that participants primed with words associated with being elderly, such as Florida and wrinkle, responded by walking at a slower pace than usual. Yeah. Incredibly, the priming of actions and thoughts is completely unconscious, and we do it without realizing that we're doing it. So what priming therefore shows is that despite what a lot of people argue, we're not in total conscious control of our actions. We're not in total conscious control of our judgments. We're not in total conscious control of our choices. In fact, we are actually instead being primed constantly by certain social and cultural conditions. Just turn on your TV. Look at all the conditioning that you see on different commercials. So to give you another example, research done by Kathleen Vose proves that the concept of money primes individualistic actions. So when you think of the concept of money, it primes individualistic actions. People primed with the idea of money, for example, through being exposed to images of money, like cash money, act more independently and are less willing to be involved with, depend on, or accept demands from others. So one implication of those research is that living in a society filled with triggers that prime money could nudge our behavior away from altruism, that is, away from actually contributing and helping others. So priming, just like other societal elements, can influence an individual's thoughts and therefore his choices, judgment, and behavior. And these reflect back into the culture and heavily affect the kind of society that we all actually live in. So this is heavy stuff, but it's really important. And I think it's also super important for us to just know these things and internalize these things so that we know and are aware of the environment that we're actually living in. So next big idea here is snap judgments. How the mind makes quick choices even when it lacks enough information to make a rational decision. Now, this is huge. Now, imagine you met someone named Ben at a party, right? You find him easy to talk to. Later, someone asks you if you know anybody who might want to contribute to their charity. You think of Ben, even though the only thing that you know about him is that he's easy to talk to. So in other words, you liked one aspect of Ben's character and you just assumed you would like everything else about him too. So we often approve or disapprove of a person even when we know little about that person. And this is so interesting to me. Our mind's tendency to oversimplify things without sufficient information often leads to judgment errors. This is called exaggerated emotional coherence, also known as the halo effect. So you put a halo on Ben, even though in truth, you really know very little, if anything, about him, aside from his name and that you find him easy to talk to. Now, this isn't the only way our minds take shortcuts in making judgments either. There's also confirmation bias. Again, that's confirmation bias, which is the tendency for people to agree with suggestions, exaggerations, and their previously held beliefs. This can be shown if we ask the question, is James friendly? Studies have shown that faced with this question, but no other information, were very, very likely to actually consider James friendly because the mind automatically confirms the suggested idea, right? So it's kind of a presupposition that you set up there by asking, is James friendly? The halo effect and confirmation bias both occur because our minds are eager to make quick judgments, fast, but this often leads to mistakes, because we don't always have enough data to make an accurate judgment. Our minds rely on false suggestions and oversimplifications to fill in the gaps in data, leading us to potentially wrong conclusions. Just like priming, these cognitive phenomena happen without our conscious awareness and affect our choices. Again, it affects our judgments. Again, it affects our actions, right? So Moving into the next big idea here, which is heuristics, how the mind uses shortcuts to make quick decisions. Now, oftentimes we need to be able to judge a situation very quickly, right? We need to make a fast judgment on something in certain situations. And to help us do this, our minds have developed little shortcuts to help us immediately understand our surroundings. And these shortcuts are called heuristics. Most of the time, these processes are actually really helpful, but our minds tend to overuse them. Using them in situations where they aren't suited can lead us to make mistakes, and sometimes pretty darn big mistakes. To get a better understanding of what heuristics are and what mistakes they can lead to, we can examine two of their many different types, the substitution heuristic and the availability heuristic. The substitution heuristic is where we answer an easier question than the one that was actually posed. Take this question, for example. That woman is a candidate for sheriff. How successful will she be in office? We automatically substitute the question we're supposed to answer with an easier one, like, does this woman look like someone who will make a good sheriff? Right? This heuristic means that instead of researching the candidate's background and policies, we merely just ask ourselves the far easier question of whether this lady looks like our mental image of a good sheriff. Unfortunately, if the woman doesn't fit our image of a sheriff, we could reject her. Even if she has years and years of crime-fighting experience and is the best candidate. Which, as a side note, we do this with political candidates all the time. Haven't you ever heard somebody say that, oh, he doesn't look like he could be president, or she doesn't look like she could be president? That's a total situation where we're making it easier on ourselves. So next, let's talk about the availability heuristic, which is where you overestimate the probability of something you hear often or find easy to remember. For example, strokes cause many more deaths than accidents do. But one study found that 80% of respondents considered accidental death more likely. This is because we hear of accidental deaths more in the media and because they make a stronger impression. We remember horrific accidental deaths more readily than deaths from strokes, and so we might react wrongly to these dangers. Next big idea, no head for numbers. Why we struggle to understand statistics and make avoidable mistakes because of it. How can you make predictions on whether certain things will happen? One effective way is to remember the base rate. This refers to a statistical base which other statistics rely on as well. For example, imagine a taxi company has 20% yellow cabs and 80% red cabs. That means that the base rate for yellow taxi cabs is 20% and the base rate for red cabs is 80%. If you order a cab and want to guess its color, remember the base rates and you'll make a good prediction. So we should therefore always remember the base rate when predicting an event. But unfortunately, again, this doesn't really happen quite as often as it should. In fact, base rate neglect is ridiculously common. One of the reasons we find ourselves ignoring the base rate is that we focus on what we expect rather than what is actually most likely. For example, imagine those cabs again. If you were to see 5 yellow cabs pass by, the probability that the next cab will be red will be pretty high, right? And if we remember the base rate, we should realize this. But instead, we tend to focus on what we expect to see, a yellow cab. And so we will be likely wrong. Base rate neglect is a common mistake connected with the wider problem of working with statistics. We also struggle to remember that everything regresses to the mean. This is the acknowledgement that all situations have their average status, and variations from that average will eventually tilt back towards the average. For example, if a football striker who averages 5 goals per month scores 10 goals in September, her coach will more than likely be ecstatic. But if she scored only 1 goal in October, her coach might criticize her play. However, she wouldn't deserve this criticism because she's only regressing to the mean. And by the way, when I say football, interchange that for soccer here in the United States. Past imperfect, why we remember events from hindsight rather than from experience. So our next idea is about the past imperfect. So our minds don't remember experiences in a straightforward way. They have two different apparatuses called memory selves, both of which remember situations differently. First, there's the experiencing self, which records how we feel in the present moment. It asks the question, how does it feel now? Then there's the remembering self, which records afterwards how the entire event was. It asks, how was it on the whole? The experiencing self gives a more accurate account of what actually occurred because our feelings during an experience are always the most accurate. But the remembering self, which is less accurate because it registers memories after the situation is finished, and that dominates our memory. So it's purely based on memory. So there are two reasons why the remembering self dominates the experiencing self. The first of these is called duration neglect, where we ignore the total duration of the event in favor of a particular memory from it. Second is the peak end rule, where we overemphasize what occurs at the end of an event. For an example of this dominance of the remembering self, take this experiment, which measured people's memories of a painful colonoscopy. Before the colonoscopy, the people were put into two groups. The patients in one group were given long, rather drawn-out colonoscopies, while those in the other group were given much shorter procedures, but where the level of pain increased towards the end. You'd think the most unhappy patients would be those who endured the longer process, as their pain was actually endured for a longer period of time. This was certainly what they felt at the time. During the process, when each patient was asked about the pain, though, their experiencing self gave an accurate answer. Those who had the longer procedures felt worse. However, after the experience, when the remembering self took over, those who went through the shorter process with the more painful ending felt the worst. The survey offers us a clear example of duration neglect, the peak end rule, and our faulty memories. Next big idea is mind over matter, how adjusting the focus of our minds can dramatically affect our thoughts and our behaviors. Now, our minds use different amounts of energy depending on the task. When there's no need to mobilize attention and there's little energy is needed, we are basically in a state of cognitive ease. Yet when our minds mobilize attention, they use more energy and enter a state of cognitive strain. These changes in the brain's energy levels have dramatic effects on how we actually behave. Now, in a state of cognitive ease, the intuitive system 1 is in charge of our minds, and the logical and more energy-demanding system 2 is weakened. This means that we're more intuitive, creative, and happier, yet we're also more likely to make mistakes. In a state of cognitive strain, our awareness is more heightened, right? And so system 2 is put in charge. System 2 is more ready to double check our judgments than system 1 is. So although we are far less creative, right, we'll make fewer mistakes. So this is more of like being in tunnel vision, right? Just doing one repetitive activity over and over and over again. That would be a good example. So you can consciously influence the amount of energy the mind uses to get in the right frame of mind for certain tasks. If you want a message to be persuasive, for example, try promoting cognitive ease. One way to do this is to change how we receive information. If information is repeated to us or made more memorable, it becomes more persuasive, right? And this is because our minds have evolved to react positively when repeatedly exposed to the same clear messages. When we see something familiar, we enter in a state of cognitive ease. Hence the reason why certain companies just use the same old tagline over and over and over and over and over again. Because when you hear it in a commercial, it puts you in cognitive ease, therefore allowing you to be persuaded more easily. So cognitive strain is good for succeeding at things like statistical problems. So this is on the other end of the spectrum here, moving out of cognitive ease, talking about cognitive strain now, which is good for, again, statistical problems and things like that. Now, we can get into this state by receiving messages that are presented to us in a confusing way. For example, via hard-to-read type. Our minds perk up and increase energy in an effort to kind of comprehend the problem, figure out what's going on, and therefore, we're less likely to just simply give up. It's pretty interesting stuff. Next big idea is taking chances. How the way probabilities are presented to us affects how we judge the levels of risk. Now, the way we judge ideas and approach problems is heavily determined by the way they are expressed to us, right? So slight changes to the details or focus of a statement or question can dramatically alter the way we actually address it. A great example of this can be found in how we assess risk. You might think that once we can determine the probability of a risk occurring, everyone will approach it in the same way, pretty much, give or take. A little detail here, a little detail there. Unfortunately, though, this is not the case. Even for carefully calculated probabilities, just changing the way the figure is actually expressed can change the way that we approach it entirely. For example, people will consider a rare event as more likely to occur if it's expressed in terms of relative frequency rather than as a statistical probability. Okay, so this is done oftentimes by telling a story rather than just presenting a bunch of numbers. So in what's known as the Mr. Jones experiment, two groups of psychiatric professionals were asked if it was safe to discharge Mr. Jones from the psychiatric hospital. The first group were told that patients like Mr. Jones had a 10% probability of committing an act of violence. And the second group was told that of every 100 patients similar to Mr. Jones, 10 are estimated to commit an act of violence. See the difference there? Of the two groups, almost twice as many respondents in the second group denied his discharge, saying they did not want that to be, did not want him to be discharged. Another way our attention is distracted from what's statistically relevant is called denominator neglect. This occurs when we ignore plain statistics in favor of vivid mental images that influence our decisions. So take these two statements, for example. This drug protects children from disease X, but has a 0.001% chance of permanent disfigurement. Versus the second statement, which is, one of 100,000 children who take this drug will be permanently disfigured. It's a lot more vivid, isn't it? Both statements, though, are totally equal. The latter statement brings to mind a disfigured child, though, and therefore is much more influential and would make us a lot less likely to administer the drug, right? Simply because we've painted that picture in our minds. When you hear that statement, it's a lot more powerful. Next idea, not robots. Why we as individuals do not make choices based purely on rational thinking. How do we as individuals actually make choices? Now, for a long time, a powerful and influential group of economists suggested that we make decisions based purely on rational argument. They argued that we all make choices, or all made choices, according to utility theory, which states that when individuals make decisions, they look only at the rational facts and choose the option with the best overall outcome for them. Well, the most influential group of economists in this field centered on the Chicago School of Economics and their most famous scholar, Milton Friedman. Their views are most likely or most easily shown in the example of the free market. Using utility theory, the Chicago School argued that individuals in the marketplace become ultra-rational econs as econs, each individual acts in the same way, valuing goods and services based on their rational needs. The price that we as econs are willing to pay for something is determined by a rational assessment of its actual worth. Take, for example, two cars. One car has a powerful engine and a good safety record, while the other is plagued by technical problems and is known to burst into flames. Under utility theory, we as econs should place a higher value on the first car than on the second because it's worth more. The economists believe that the value of all goods and services was determined in this highly effective way. But as we've seen, humans aren't rational creatures. Our minds use processes and shortcuts to make quick judgments that can often lead us to make errors in judgment. Processes such as heuristics and denominator neglect mean we constantly act irrationally and even strangely. We are, in short, not econs. Next big idea is about gut feeling. Why, rather than making decisions on rational considerations alone, we are often swayed by emotional factors. So if utility theory doesn't work, what does? One alternative is prospect theory, developed by the author himself, Daniel Kahneman. Kahneman's prospect theory challenges utility theory by showing that when we make choices, we don't always act in the most rational way. Imagine these two scenarios, for example. In the first scenario, you're given $1,000 and then must choose between receiving a definite $500 or taking a 50% chance to win another $1,000. In the second scenario, you're given $2,000 and must then choose between a sure loss of $500 or taking a 50% chance on losing $1,000. If we made purely rational choices, then we'd make the same choice in both cases. But this isn't the case. In the first instance, most people choose to take the sure bet, while in the second case, most people take a gamble. Prospect theory helps to explain why this is the case. It highlights at least two reasons why we don't always act rationally. Both of them, by the way, feature our loss aversion, the fact that we fear losses more than we value gains. Again, the fact that we fear losses more than we value gains. So the first reason is that we value reference points. Starting with $1,000 or $2,000 in the two scenarios changes whether we're willing to gamble because the starting point affects how we value our position. Even though our reasoning here is clearly irrational, we understand value as much by our starting point as by the actual objective value at the time. Second, we're influenced by the diminishing sensitivity principle. Now, the value we perceive may be different from its actual worth. In terms of the example, the perceived value of going from $1,000 to $500 is greater than going from $2,000 to $1,500, despite the fact that the monetary value of both losses is equal. So, next big idea, false images. Why the mind builds complete pictures to explain the world, but they lead to overconfidence and mistakes. In order to understand situations, our minds naturally use cognitive coherence, We complete a mental picture to explain things like an idea or concept. For example, we have many images in our brain for the weather. We have an image for, say, summer weather, which might be a picture of a bright, hot sun bathing us in heat, as well as helping us to understand things. We also rely on these images when making a decision. When we make decisions, we refer to these pictures and build our assumptions and conclusions based on them. For example, if we want to know what clothes to wear in summer, we base our decisions on our image of that season's weather. The problem is that we place too much confidence in these actual images. Even when available statistics and data disagree with our mental pictures, we still let the images guide us. In summer, the weather forecaster might predict relatively cool weather, yet you might still go out in shorts and a t-shirt, as that's what your mental image of summer tells you to wear. You might then end up outside in clothes far too cold for the weather, right? So we are, in short, massively overconfident of our often faulty mental images. But there are ways to overcome this overconfidence and start making better decisions. One way to avoid mistakes is to utilize reference class forecasting. Instead of making judgments based on your rather general mental images, use specific historical examples to make a more accurate forecast. In addition, you can devise a long-term risk policy that plans specific measures in the case of both success and failure in forecasting. Through preparation and protection, you can rely on evidence instead of general mental pictures and make more accurate forecasts as a result of doing so. So let's close it out. Closing notes here. The key message of this book is, again, Thinking Fast and Slow shows us that our minds contain two systems. The first system, System 1, acts instinctively and requires very little effort, right? The second system, System 2, is more deliberate. It requires much more of our attention. Our thoughts and actions will vary depending on which of the two systems is in control of our brain at the time. Okay, so next key message is that Daniel Kahneman also explains the inherent laziness of our minds. Our brains are quick to take shortcuts to save energy. We aren't really aware of this, and so we're liable to make mistakes because we tend to trust the quick answers our brain provides. Only by knowing that this laziness actually exists can we hope to make better judgments. All right, so some actionable insights from this flash note here is that obviously follow the two items that I just mentioned above, and keep in mind that messages are more persuasive when we're repeatedly exposed to them. So keep that in mind as you're repeatedly exposed to advertisements and messages and to certain catchphrases and things like that. And also keep it in mind if you are looking to persuade others with your message or with your services, products, programs, whatever it may be. And again, keep in mind that we're messages are more persuasive when they're repeatedly exposed to an individual. And it's probably because we evolved in a way that made repeated exposure to things that had no bad consequences as deemed as inherently good, right? So if you walk by an apple tree and you do that over and over and over again, it doesn't do anything to you and you're repeatedly exposed to it, just like many other things that you're repeatedly exposed to in life, there aren't any bad consequences and it's deemed inherently good. But if somebody repeatedly says the same thing to you over and over and over again and it's a lie, then you use all that past conditioning to just accept that as if it were good. So don't be influenced by rare statistical events that are overreported in newspapers. That's a huge thing. Don't let the media garbage just influence you in a negative way. Next is that disasters and other events are important historical events, but we often overestimate their statistical probability because of the vivid images that we associate with them from the actual media, right? So they blow it up, make it huge, make it a lot worse than it really is, when in fact it's just an event that happened for the first time in a long time. Or, you know, we make them bigger than they are sometimes because of the images that and the way in which they're portrayed. And then finally, the last two closing it out is that you're more creative and intuitive when you're in a better mood. So, you know, if you're undertaking a huge project and you're getting ready to just work on something and you really want to crush it, then put yourself in a good mood, because you'll be more creative, you'll be more intuitive, you'll be more engaged, and you'll overall do a better job. And when you're in a better mood, the part of the mind that's alert and analytical tends to just relax. And that cedes control of your mind to the more intuitive and quicker thinking system, which also makes you more creative. If you enjoyed today's episode of the Flash Notes Podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you took just a minute or so to review our podcast in iTunes. And if you're interested in learning more about Flash Notes book summaries, come on over to getflashnotes.com. Again, that's getflashnotes.com, and you can sign up for $1 and get access to business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. Thanks again for listening. My name is Dean Bukhari, and I will see you on the next episode right here on the Flash Notes Podcast.